I'm Dan Marcus, and this is Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. Surf's up again, dude, with the third and final installment of my interview with Dean Torrence of Jan and Dean. In part one, we learned about their early recording days, recording in Jan's garage. Dean related the story about meeting Paul McCartney and his wife Linda, about whom Jan and Dean had a hit called Linda. Dean also related the story of Tom Hanks' compliment to Jan and Dean, and we heard the tragic story of the Grammy Award that Dean won and what happened to it. That was part one. Part two, we found out what Beach Boys song Dean Torrence got a gold record for. And we found out what world-famous international incident was traced back by USA Today to Jan and Dean. Now, it's time for our third and final installment with Dean Torrence. It was recorded during 2020's COVID-19 quarantine period. We find out who Catherine Milner was, and you're about to hear the bizarre story about why Jan and Dean sang the title track to the Hollywood movie Ride the Wild Surf, but was not only excluded from being in the movie, but banned from the set entirely. Why? It's a bizarre story and it's coming up. You'll find out what Jan and Dean thought of the Beatles as competitors. And we'll finally get around to talking about Surf City, Jan and Dean's famous number one song. And we'll talk about Jan's well-known car crash. And interestingly, how Dean heard the news about it. That's all ahead. So Dean Torrence, who loves to tell a story, has some good stories ahead for you in the next few minutes on Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. I got a one question, Jan and Dean trivia question. Let's see if you know the answer, okay?
All right.
Who is Catherine Milner?
Just to show you how organized I am, I'm picking up off of a stack of paper that I just worked with yesterday, since we can't go outside.
And you've been working on a book.
I'm working on a book, so I scanned, and the book was, you know, about graphic design and include a bunch of Jan and Dean album covers, blah, blah, blah.
Okay.
And I just scanned this yesterday, and the title is Where It All Began. It has a picture of a Dodge 240 horsepower, it says, on the side.
Is that a super
and
stock
a
Dodge?
Little old lady driving it, and on the side of the car, written real big, it says Little Old, O-L, with an apostrophe, Lady, Dodge Dealers. And she's at the drag strip. And then the article goes on to say this is where it all began, and the whole campaign about how the little old lady put a Dodge in your garage, honey. So it's a whole article about the Dodge dealers.
Yeah.
And how, you know, the Dodge company was making muscle cars, so they were trying to sell them to
right.
young people, right?
Right.
So Catherine Milner was the little old lady that they picked to be the face of their advertising campaign, Catherine Milner. Born in 1892.
Wow.
She passed away in 1969.
Oh, man. She was the face of the Dodge commercials and also the Jan and Dean video for Little Old Lady from Pasadena.
Yep. Great lady.
Props to you.
She was a lot of fun.
She was 80-something, let's see, probably, 72 or so, when she modeled as a as an actress in your videos, as well as the Dodge commercials, right?
Yeah.
Terrific.
Wow. And she was in the union SAG or one of those, because she did a lot of commercials.
Yeah.
She was a neat personality, and she photographed well, and she was spunky. And perfect for all that.
Oh, I like that.
Now, my disappointment with all of that was that she was featured in a commercial that Jan and I saw, and then that gave us the inspiration to write the song.
Okay.
Once we saw the commercial, and we said, what a great character, and it also for branding of Jan and Dean for not doing sappy love songs, this was right up our alley.
Yeah,
you know,
okay.
A little old lady in a car that she takes to the drags, you know, or in street races. Perfect character.
Yes.
Had enough humor in it, tongue in cheek. It checked all the boxes for the type of songs that we should be doing. So we wrote the song, recorded the song, and then sent it to the advertising agency for Dodge Chrysler, saying, okay, here's the song for your commercial with that little old lady person.
Perfect. Man, you were working it.
Isn't that perfect? Come on, man. We knew what we were doing.
You guys were thinking out of the box all the time, and that's what made Jan and Dean so special, I thought.
Now, that's a nice story.
That's a great story.
But we set it off to those people, McCann, Erickson, or whatever, big-time guys, and we heard crickets.
Really? Really?
Now, wouldn't you think, I mean, a man of radio like you are, how many corporations would have loved to be involved with the top 10 song?
Yeah. 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 Why did they walk away from it? Did the publisher want too much money for the rights or something? What happened?
No. Unfortunately, we then later found out, after we'd gone to all the trouble to record it and all that, that the commercial we were looking at was not a national commercial, but it was a local Dodge Dealers, the West Coast version of the Dodge Dealers.
Okay.
So it wasn't national, you see. The national people thought, that's just those crazy Californians making some really stupid commercial.
What? You
know, we're McCann Erickson. We don't deal in stuff like that.
We don't.
You're trying to sell muscle cars to young people. That's what our demographic is. Hello.
Yeah, we don't need a. Did they think the little old lady was wrong image or something for the car?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh. Oh.
So it only worked in Southern California, and Southern California Dodge Dealers. The agency didn't want anybody to think they didn't think of it.
Wow.
And
I
pretty much confronted all that stuff most of my life. They didn't think of it. And so the deal was to make it look like it was somebody else's idea they would become involved.
Well, let me... That's
what the game was.
Let me give you another example of grown-ups overthink, And I'm talking about Ride the Wild Surf. You weren't allowed in the movie, even though you sang the theme song, the hit theme song to the movie.
Well.
And remember, this falls under the category of adult overthink.
Yes, no kidding.
Yeah.
Briefly, because it's an hour and a half, really, that's an hour and a half story.
Okay.
But briefly, and when you do look it up or Google it, you will see that it's true. Two of Jan and Dean's best friends who were in our kind of car club, social club,
In high school.
We were the Barons. That was the name of our club.
Okay.
And these guys were the guys that we would sing doo-wop with. And our first group was going to be called the Barons. We were all tight, blood brothers, and all that kind of stuff. Two of our characters out of that group of guys kidnapped Frank Sinatra Jr. They thought that was a good idea.
Okay, keep going. That's so absurd when you hear you say that.
Well, I have a unique way of making it even more absurd than it really was. No, it is pretty absurd.
Yeah, you're right. So,
we live in Hollywood or close to Hollywood, so none of this stuff seemed absurd to us at the time.
Yeah, I suppose.
But so, and one of those buddies approached me. This is after we were out of high school.
Yeah.
Jan and I are making records. This is up to like the mid 60s. We've been out of high school since the late 50s. But this buddy had also been involved in the stock market. So my buddy was selling stocks. So I bought stock from him because I trusted him.
So you stayed friends after high school?
Stock market. Yeah. Continued from high school. We were friends. I was best man at his wedding.
Really? Okay.
The other character was closer to Jan, and they did a lot of stuff socially, double dated a lot. But we're all friends. I mean, everybody in the club was one of those brotherhood things. So this friend of mine made me some pretty good money in the stock market, and I didn't really need the money particularly, but it was nice.
Yeah.
And it helped him out. He was able to sell some stock and, you know, get commissions and all that.
Yep.
So it did pretty well. And then something happened. I don't know what I mean. It may have been one of those downturns or whatever. And then all of a sudden he was out of a job.
Oh.
And so, he would come to me and ask me for loans. I knew he was very bright, so I figured, he'll make it through these downturns. And the money was like a couple hundred bucks.
Okay, sure.
It's never a lot of money. And this went on for about a year and a half. One day he wants to meet with me, and I knew whenever he called me at home, wanted to meet with me, he was wanted to borrow more money. So I'd always make it hard for him. So I said, I have to be at school. I can't see you until maybe after school. He wanted to do it now.
Right.
I said, well, meet me at USC. Meet me by Tommy Trojan. You can ask anybody where the statue is.
Right.
It's right by the library in this nice grassy area, and we can sit there and meet during my lunch break. I really didn't think he'd show up. It'd be too complicated. Everyone would be able to find it. Anyway, well, he was smart. He found it, so we sat down. He tells me he's in a lot of trouble financially, and he'd borrowed money from, obviously, from me and from his dad, his mom, and almost everybody he could borrow a little bit of money from. He said, I'm going to tell you my business plan, and don't laugh. And I said, okay. He said, the only thing I can think of at the moment is a crime.
Wait a minute.
He said, you said you wouldn't laugh. I said, okay.
Kidnapping Frank Sinatra Jr. was his business plan?
Yeah, it was his business plan. He had it all worked out. I mean, he was a very methodical kind of guy, and had this all worked out.
Wow.
Down to almost every detail.
Wow.
Now, he didn't tell me who he had in mind.
Okay.
In the beginning.
Okay.
But he just said that he'd researched kidnapping.
Wow.
And, nobody gets hurt. You don't have to pull a gun at anybody. It isn't one of those. It's more of a white-collar crime in his mind.
Okay.
And it
that,
just
gee, that justifies it, doesn't it?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. Nobody gets hurt. just
by the way,
kidnap.
I'm working on maybe a movie version of this with John Stamos.
Oh, cool.
Don't tell anybody, though.
No, we're only on a podcast right now, Dean.
Yeah.
Both my listeners are sworn to secrecy.
Okay. They won't remember this 10 minutes from now anyway. If I remember those two.
Yes.
Yeah. They've fallen asleep by this time anyway, I think.
Stop it.
Watching the Golden Girls.
Okay.
So I hear the business plan. I've only laughed maybe two or three times.
Yeah.
And then he would get mad at me. Actually, would get mad.
Yeah.
He said, it's just a business transaction. And the payoff was, once he got the money was going to be invested, and he had the whole business plan for that, a piece of property that he'd been looking at.
Oh, wow.
And if he'd be able to pay, and again, I didn't know this was Sinatra at the time, he'd be able to pay back Mr. Sinatra within, I think he figured, 2 years.
Okay.
With interest.
With interest, even. That's a very courteous criminal.
Yes, well, that's justifying the whole thing, and he was a Catholic, and he'd asked God if it was okay.
Wow.
And that nobody would get hurt, and that he would pay Mr. Sinatra back. So God hadn't really said one way or another.
Yeah, I don't think God really, he wasn't in on the plan, was he?
According to him, yes,
okay.
At times.
So okay.
This was just entertaining to me,
because
I really didn't think he was actually going to, anybody that I knew was capable of actually really doing such a thing.
Wow. Well, but the
and
thing
is,
Southern California.
Else would come along and he would be okay, and then, that was just a stupid dream, a pipe
right.
dream that I
yeah.
had or something. And damn if he didn't do it.
So how did you find out? Were you reading the newspaper and Frank Sinatra Jr. has been kidnapped and you put two and two together?
He called me early one morning and said, guess what?
Oh, no.
Because I hadn't heard from him in 3 or 4 weeks or so. I thought he was on to something else, and God bless him, I hoped he was. He said, I think the last time I talked to him, he was rethinking it and wasn't going to do it. And I get the call. I swear he said somebody took Frank Sinatra Jr. from Harrah's Casino in Tahoe last night.
Wow.
And I was stunned.
Wow.
And my reaction to it was, because he said somebody, and I said, well, it's got to be somebody you know that you told the plan to, you know, and then they took it and ran with it. And then I don't know how he put it, because then he probably put me in so much shock I don't remember. And oh my God. Then what do you do?
Yeah, then what do you do? I mean, this is your longtime buddy, but then do you have an obligation to call the police? I mean, it's a rhetorical question.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah.
I trusted that he and my other friend, you know, were not criminals, and they certainly wouldn't hurt anybody. And if it got sticky, they would let him go. I believed that, and I just held on to that. You know, it went on for at least, I think, 3 or 4 days.
Okay, yeah, I was wondering how long that was, yeah.
And the crux of the whole thing was just to show that he was thinking of this as an investment.
Yeah.
That this ransom was an investment.
Yeah.
Was that the FBI were telling Mr. Sinatra that expect, you know, they're kidnappers. They're going to be asking, they think of you as a multimillionaire, so they're going to ask for a chunk of money, probably in the range of, you know, maybe even $1 million.
Yeah.
And can you raise that amount? He said, oh, yeah, I think so. I said, well, at least get it in place if you can, because you're going to be facing that question very soon. And the call did come in.
Yeah.
And my buddies were too afraid to talk to him.
Himself, directly, yeah.
So they brought in another partner who's an older guy. He was in his 40s.
Is that their investment broker?
No. This is a house painter.
Really? Oh, no. Jeez.
Oh. Painted one of the guy's mom's house or something like
that.
Wow. I don't know.
Oh, geez.
And he was next con, so he wouldn't be intimidated. He had a gravelly voice. And so my buddy had written a script for him for the negotiations for the ransom.
Okay.
And it had been timed. They knew that stuff could be traced and all that. So it was timed, and this guy was to say this particular thing and not stray and get into any long, drawn-out conversations.
Right, yeah. That's
kind
smart.
Of to the point. So, okay, so the call comes, and Sinatra's up in... Why am I telling this story? Oh, yeah, you asked.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay. It was a long way, I told you. Now, I'm getting to the...
Yeah, why weren't... Yeah, remember the original question was, why weren't you allowed on the set of Ride the Wild Surf? But keep going.
Yeah, okay. So I didn't want anybody to think these people were total crooks that we associated with. So this needed to be part of the story.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Yeah.
So the call comes
Makes
in.
Makes sense. That's fine.
Sinatra's, you know, prepared to have to come up with cash, you know, up to $1 million. And the call comes in, and of course, a little bit of small talk, like, you know, is my kid okay? Yes, he is. And can I talk to him? No, not right now, but you know, we need to get down to the business. Okay. The FBI is all listening, and they all headsets listening to the conversation. Okay, let's get to it. Okay. The FBI said, you approach the money, you know, up front before they get to, just so that they know, just in case I might be asking for $20 million. We don't know. But cut them off, tell them what you can raise so that this thing can be done quickly and over.
Yeah.
So Sinatra goes right to the money, and Sinatra says, I can only get so much cash, and you know, the quickest I can come up with cash, the quickest amount of money is, you know, maybe close to $1 million, and that's all I can do. And so I'm just letting you know if you want this over with. And well, actually, no. And now the FBI going, oh, here it goes.
Yeah,
it says here.
It says here, so he's looking at the script.
And he does say, it says here, because he's reading it. It says here, 200, and they're going, 200? And I could imagine the FBI going, 200 million? 240,000.
But all Frank, and the chairman of the board says, all I can get for you is four times that.
I know. that to me is a crux to the story, and it's one of the best parts of the story.
That's a great story.
To me, that scene of all the FBI dudes and everybody listening in, kind of all looking at it, wait a minute. What the hell is going on? Like, did we hear that right? He said 240. But Mr. Notcher just offered him a million, and they went less.
not real good. Not the kinds of people you want to be your manager, you know?
No, just not.
Wow, that's so funny.
My friend who, thought this whole thing up, he had done all the numbers, and that's all he needed was 240. He wanted to be able to pay it back, so he didn't want to risk
with interest.
With interest, so 240 would do it for him, and then he could get his project done, and he could pay everybody back. Investment.
Wow.
I mean, the FBI is sitting there. Why not 250? Why 240? And they were just dumbfounded. Okay.
So what's all this got to do with Ride the Wild Surf, Dean?
Well, this all happened right around Ride the Wild Surf, and of course, when it all blew up, and obviously it did, but they actually had Sinatra Jr. for a couple of days, and then they got their $240,000, and then I think they had that money for at least another 3 days, 4 days. Then they got caught because the old guy flipped and went to the police and told them. They were closing in on him anyway. So, of course, now it's all over the media that Sinatra kidnappers have been caught and, of course, named them and all this kind of stuff. And then all of a sudden they find out I had been loaning this guy money.
Oh, sure.
And that some of that money was going to, to fund the whole thing.
Oh, okay.
So they thought, pretty much the feds, they were curious to why I was loaning this guy money, and the money was going to kidnapping. Of course, I told them I had no idea where the money was going.
Well, no.
That I'd been loaning him money for a year, year and a half. I had all the paperwork, more or less. I don't know what he's doing with
Seemed
the money.
Up and up to you.
Yeah, and they were okay with that. They could see I didn't really need the money, and why would I be involved? Something's weird as that.
Yeah, that's weird too.
So I get pulled in though, and they're starting to. So my name is, shown up in the press. And then when the trial started, I was a witness, and Jan was a witness. Jan had no idea. So we're in court, and of course, being in court and being sucked into this, and of course, the defensive lawyers, not the prosecution guys, defensive lawyers wanted to make it look like we were part of it.
Oh.
Because after all, Sinatra Jr. also had a recording career along with his father. They both used the same studios we used. I was living maybe a quarter of a mile from Frank Sinatra Jr. His apartment was. We both bought our gas at the same gas station. Obviously, we knew one another, and we didn't.
Okay.
I'd never met any of them, but Jan had been to the Sinatra house pretty many times because he and his parents lived up in Bel Air, and they were neighbors to Nancy Sinatra, who was pretty much separated or divorced from Frank.
Okay.
And Nancy Sinatra went to our high school, so we were all friends.
Okay.
All went to or at least Jan went to parties at their house. I never did. So Jan did have a connection, and so the defense lawyers thought, well, we can say Jan and Ian put the kidnappers together with Sinatra, and this was a publicity stunt.
Oh, no. Publicity stunt?
And,
seriously?
Some people believe anything,
Yeah.
Dealing with a jury, they confuse the jury enough, the jury might believe that.
Conspiracy theorists were alive even then, weren't they?
Alive even then, yep.
Yeah, wow.
But just shows you, if the press goes after you, they can say whatever they want. So
was the record, was the movie company afraid you were going to kidnap Tab Hunter and Fabian in the movie?
Yeah, that's what they said, or Shelley Fabre.
Oh, man.
Well, we would have kidnapped a girl.
Yeah.
She was dating our manager, so I think maybe they were married. So.
Oh, boy.
Lou probably wouldn't have been happy with that. So.
Oh, Lou Adler. Sure. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. That all comes together for me. That fascinating story.
So we got kicked out of the movie, and we didn't particularly want to be in the movie because we were in enough trouble with our surfing buddies that thought we'd sold out anyhow. So we really didn't want to be in the movie, but they said, well, then, you know, we don't need you to do the title song. We really wanted to do the title song. So we said, okay.
I ask you this question one other time, and your answer fascinated me. And the question was, you had this big, long career, several years on the charts, and then all of a sudden the Beatles hit, and so many artists pre-Beatles just lost their careers practically overnight. Were you afraid of the competition from the Beatles?
No, we never looked at that they were competition. We actually thought they were helping the industry, which they really did, and it made rock and roll even more relevant and relevant to a bigger audience.
Okay.
We loved it. You know, the way we always looked at all of that stuff was, look in the charts, there's 100 spots there.
Okay.
You know? Yeah. So there's plenty of room, and they seem like nice guys, and their music at the time weren't all that different than what the rest of us were doing.
That's true. But and you know what? That's the same exact answer you gave me the first time I asked you that question.
Glad I'm consistent.
Yes, 30. About I looked it up. That first I asked you, we first met in 1981. So you've been consistent almost 40 years with that answer. So, but good for you.
You know, I'm in trouble at a time when I, you know, say some 180 degrees.
No. You were a spy. You said this virtually the same thing. You thought they were good for the industry even then. So,
then they were. And I was always into, again, I mean, to this earlier, I was kind of in charge of the branding. And then sometimes we, you know, Jan would insist on something and kind of leave our branding, but only momentarily. But I loved that they were branding themselves kind of like I was hoping to do with us.
Okay.
And that your album covers all had some sort of theme to them, and that you came up with concepts, that you did total campaigns around and kept everything, the continuity between what you were doing.
That's listen.
Quotes your branding.
You were really good
at it.
You were really good at it. I'm glad you brought up branding, because I just noticed in the last couple of years, every single picture of Jan and Dean has Jan on the left and Dean on the right, as if you were reading the names left to right. That's not an accident.
Exactly. No.
Whose idea was that? Was that you? Was that Mr. Marketing?
Probably mine, but. Yeah, but Jan was very conscious of it, and it almost felt like, you know, oh, of course, you know, we should do that.
And even on stage, you were Jan and Dean, left to right.
Yeah, I didn't even think of that. Yeah, you're right.
Jan was always on your right, so that people looking at the stage would see Jan on the left and Dean on the right, Jan and Dean. And I never even, that hit me between the eyes a couple of years ago.
Except if you were in Japan, see, they read from right to left, and we'd have to switch over. That's why we never played Japan. So
okay.
That would have mixed us up badly. But yeah, you need to be consistent. We even were consistent when we finally got control over your studio pictures and made sure that we got to pick the shots that were going to be used. And that they always had some sort of sense of humor in them and weren't straight just portraits.
Cool.
Like they forced us to do in the 50s.
Well, yeah, that was the age of conformity, sure.
Right. And then your liner notes also follow the same continuity, make sure that there was humor in them. So your written word was all done at the same time, and everybody, including the public relations people and all that, were on board and knew what picture you were going to use, what kind of message your messaging was, and it started to work pretty well. But we never quite, you know, Jan had his accent. We were never able to fully implement all that stuff.
Well, you bring up the accident.
I did for others. That's how I finally did it for other people.
And you won a Grammy for it. 4 nominations and 1 win for Best Album Cover. That doesn't happen by accident.
I guess not. And luckily, I was working with really talented people, and that were bright and knew what it was we were trying to affect.
Makes,
you know,
a difference. Yeah. You mentioned the accident, and I promised in part one that I would ask about the accident, and I know you must be very tired of talking about that, but Jan crashed his Stingray after an encounter with the Selective Service, who wanted to draft him, and I even have Jan, an interview with Jan that I did in 81, talking about his accident. A couple of questions around that. How did you find out about the car crash, the accident? Who told you?
It was in the morning. He had, he was very accident prone there. He had broken his, compound fractured his leg.
Oh, geez.
The summer before. And with a compound fractured leg, another accident, making a movie, that's a whole other story.
Okay.
Compound fracture, so he had lots of pins and all that stuff in his leg. So when school started, by now he's in med school, 1965-ish, you know, he could barely walk for a couple of months. He had, from the draft board, he had a deferment.
Okay, because of that.
Because he was in med school.
Oh, sure. Okay, yeah.
Being a doctor. So if he's in med school or actually had his doctorate, then he wasn't going to get called for the draft.
Do students in architecture school get draft deferments?
Hell no.
Okay. Thought I'd ask.
But I was smart enough to go. I went in the service in between leaving high school and
that's right.
College.
Yep.
For 6 months, I got in on the reserve program.
You were
so I only lost a summer. But our summers were so special. Damn.
Oh,
but anyway,
yeah.
I got it out of the way. And by the time Vietnam rolled around, I had totally finished all my commitments to the armed services. Now it's all done.
Okay, so back to the accident. I'm sorry.
I didn't have to worry about it. He had to worry about it. Now, since he compound fractured his leg, he had to take a leave from school. But they did say, next semester, when you're healthy, you're welcome back to med school.
Right.
But the fact that he wasn't technically in med school at the time made him technically eligible for the draft. So he started getting a draft note. So he finally showed up at the draft board. He still got a cast, a full cast on his leg. Still, it's very painful.
Yeah.
He goes and he shows them his leg and says that's why he, and his paperwork from schools saying that he was registered to start school the next semester and that his deferment should take care of all that. You know, whatever the thing was, it wasn't settled, and of course it's still up in the air, so he most likely is still kind of pissed off when he left there. And driving wasn't all that easy for him to do anyway, and about 25 minutes later, he crashed his car into the back of a parked truck in Beverly Hills on his way to a meeting with one of our record company executives.
Who told you?
I was at school, walking across campus. One of my buddies came up to me and said, hey, you know, how's Jan? I said, I was living up at his house at the time. I'd seen him in the morning when I left, and I knew he was going to the draft board, but I thought that was going to be no big deal. I mean, he didn't have a deferment. So last I saw him, he was fine. It's fine this morning. What do you mean? He said, oh, my God, I just heard on the radio that he was in a car wreck earlier today.
Oh, man.
And he was in critical condition.
Oh.
I said, oh, damn.
Wow.
I had to go find a payphone called Lou's office because I was sure.
Your manager.
Yep, and he already checked it out, knew that Jan was at UCLA. He was in a coma.
Oh.
Blah, blah, blah. So it looked very serious.
Yeah.
So that's how I found out.
Wow. That's brutal. But to your credit.
I think we were supposed to record that night, too, because I remember, well, you know, I had my priorities. So I remembered that I had broken a date with this girl that I was really interested in because I had to record. So I was able to call her up and just say, oh, okay, well, I guess I'm not recording tonight. That's before I really, you know, went to the hospital and really saw how serious it was. Jan was so lucky, usually. Nothing ever happened to him.
Not this time.
So I just couldn't believe anything that bad would actually really happen to him.
The photo of the car is just...
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, that's out there. It's on the internet, and that is... Can't even tell it was a Stingray.
No.
Wow.
Which, the fact that it was a Stingray was probably kept him from being killed. I'm convinced if that were a metal car, it would have collapsed around him.
Okay.
And I don't think he would have survived. But the fact that it was fiberglass, it kind of absorbed a lot of the energy.
Okay.
And he ended up just hitting his head.
Gee.
He did have a seatbelt on, but he didn't have shoulder harnesses.
They didn't make those then, I don't think.
No. Well, I was getting them. I always had shoulder harnesses. In the 50s, I would get them at the war surplus stores.
Really?
That they came from fighter airplanes.
Okay.
And they were quick release, because if you hit something and you needed to get out of the airplane or get out of the car, you just one action, you were out. So I always had shoulder harnesses. And if he'd probably had those in his Stingray, I had them in mine, I'm not sure his head would have gone far enough forward to where it hit the molding that kind of holds the windshield in.
Wow.
This is hard hitting the head. Other than that, that whack in the head, he kind of survived it.
Well, and he was such a determined individual personality-wise. My guess is he was just too stubborn to let it do him in. Is there any truth to that?
Yeah, I think you're exactly right. I think most people, including maybe even me, probably would have given up, just gone, there's nothing I can do about it. I'm just screwed.
But not Jim.
Not him.
Nope.
I mean, it isn't as though he recovered fully. He absolutely didn't. And I guess if you saw him at 81, you know, he was well enough, and the fans were just happy he was there.
Yeah.
And they cut him a little slack if his vocals weren't great.
But I think
through the 80s, his vocals were pretty okay.
I thought so at the time. And going back and seeing some stuff on YouTube, I think you did a pretty admirable...
Yeah.
To get up out of that bed was remarkable enough, but now he's singing and performing in front of thousands of people. What a guy. I mean, what determination. Yeah. Okay, happier times. We've talked for a long time here, and I got to ask you about Surf City. It was your number one song for you, the biggest hit you ever had. It was number one for 2 weeks on the charts and really helped to define the whole surfing genre. And it was number one in the summertime. That didn't hurt.
No.
But the song came to you, and it was an uncompleted song, half written by Brian Wilson. Do I have that part of the story right?
Yep.
Did you know it was going to be a hit as soon as you heard it first time?
We knew everything Brian wrote was good.
Okay.
Brian was trying to figure out which song to complete. And he was working, most writers work on two or three songs at a time, and they get tired of one and they jump off on another. But at this time, he was working on his version of Surfin' USA.
Oh, okay.
And or, you know, Surf City. And he kept gravitating back to Surfin' USA. You know, he played Surfin' USA for us just to see our thoughts. And oh my God, you know, we absolutely loved it. But we said, Brian, that song was written by Chuck Berry. You are a songwriter, but you will not be able to take credit for this, nor will you get any publishing for this, because Chuck Berry owns it. You can't just change the words. What's that Chuck Berry song?
Sweet Little 16, isn't it?
Yeah. I guess so.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, right. Call your two nerds. Oh, they're asleep. They're asleep by now. Okay, never mind.
Okay, thank you.
And their assistant.
You take too much delight in calling me a nerd, but I don't mind. It's a badge of honor with you, Dean.
I like nerds.
Okay, thank you.
So we tried to talk him out of it for him to be doing it. We said we knew Chuck Berry, who we did, and I said, so we could negotiate with him publishing. He probably won't give up his publishing, but we could get his permission. He seems to like it somewhat.
Right.
And, I mean, Chuck Berry and Jan Berry, you know, they were just brothers of different mothers.
Okay, kind of. Right.
You know, so we could do this where, you know, and I'm not sure you can, or whether or not he would listen to you guys, because he's Chuck Berry. So if you want our opinion, we could use that song better, and we'll give you co-producer or something if you want.
Okay.
And he said, no, you really didn't want to give that song up, and he thinks it's a good idea. And his dad said it was okay.
Oh.
We said, Brian, your dad works in a machine shop. You know,
Are you saying Murray Wilson okayed Brian giving up Surf City?
No, I guess the question that Brian had with his dad was, if I take this song, Sweet Little 16, and I change the words, is it my song? And his dad said, yeah.
Oh.
You changed the words. No, he couldn't have been wronger. Is that a word, wronger?
Yeah, that works.
Anyway,
I know what you mean.
He was mistaken.
Yeah.
And so Brian was convinced that his dad knew because his dad had written a song that Lawrence Welk recorded.
Yes, I know that. Yeah, that's a great story.
Yeah. So Brian said, well, no, but if you want a surf song, so I was working on this other song, and I'm not going to finish because I'm going to concentrate on finishing this, and this other one's too similar, so it's one or the other, so you can have this other one and finish it, and it's yours. And he gave us a half-finished Surf City, which we still would have rather had.
Okay.
Chuck Berry version, because it was a backbeat in the key of E, and it was easy, and it had all that Chuck Berry guitar stuff. We loved Chuck Berry. But yeah.
Oh, you would rather have had Surfin' USA. Did I have?
Us, yes.
Oh, okay. Gotcha. So you were reluctant.
He wouldn't give it up.
Between the two, you were reluctant to take Surf City from Brian.
No, we'd take it, but we were still trying to talk him out of it.
Okay.
By he being a young songwriter, it's not going to help his career as a songwriter if he records a Chuck Berry song.
Gotcha. Okay.
And we weren't writers particularly, so we're not trying to build up a publishing company. You're not going to get publishing for Surfin' USA. You will for Surf City.
And there's a lot of money in publishing.
The song to finish is Surf City.
Okay.
But he wouldn't budge. I said, okay, I mean, we like it, but the smarter way for you to do it would be to do it the way we're telling you.
Okay.
Which it did catch up with him. Chuck Berry did sue him, and then Chuck Berry got the writing credit, got publishing and all that.
For Surfin' USA.
Yeah. I mean, they still had a hit, and it's a great song.
Right. So who finished up the lyrics on Surf City?
I think just the three of us. Of course, yeah. I didn't get any credit for it.
Yeah.
Which I thought I was, and then the record came out. I said, hey, you left my name off. Oh, I'm sorry.
Oops. Yeah, there's a little friction going on there.
In those days, a song had a shelf life of 3 months.
So right.
Uh-huh. I didn't really. It was like getting a fight with Jan over something that's going to be here and gone in 3 months. Chose not to, but here we are.
Yeah, here we are, you know, decades later.
My one third of the songwriting would have put my kids through college.
Yep. Yeah, that's a shame.
I have the original handwritten lyrics that we used when we recorded the song.
Oh, man. I'd love to see those. It'd be nice if you could share those with everybody by taking a picture of it and just posting it online somewhere. That would be cool. But
yeah, I'll send it to you.
I would appreciate it.
I'll email it to you. It's handwritten. It's not Jan's writing. It's in Brian's writing.
Oh, my.
It's cursive. I print. I don't write in cursive.
Okay.
So it's his writing. Total song written out, even with the lyrics we had already kind of held on.
Okay.
And then in the studio, I even came up with some other changes that I like. And he was okay with that. So in my printing, I made some pretty dramatic changes.
That's pretty cool. Wow.
So that, and I have, you know, so for anybody that said I didn't co-write it, I have proof. And I think some Jan fans accused me of trying to take credit for it. And said I was trying to get credit for something I didn't do.
Yeah,
I said, well, I got the original lyrics written in Brian's writing and with my printing, and actually I don't see anything written by Jan.
If somebody likes Jan, they should like Dean too. Come on. It's just,
I think the different camps came after the accident.
Okay.
Because all of a sudden I was in charge.
Oh,
some didn't
yeah.
like that.
Okay, I'm going to ask you one more question here because you mentioned him briefly. Murray Wilson. Are you a fan of his?
Not particularly.
No.
I mean, he was probably your quintessential stage dad.
Okay. He was a little wacky too, I think.
The whole family was a little dysfunctional, to be sure. But at the very least, you know, he encouraged his kids to do music, and so you got to give him that.
Yes, absolutely.
He just didn't, you know, I guess as Clint Eastwood would say, man's got to know his limitations.
Mm-hmm.
If he just stayed that way, he would have been in the picture a lot longer and been given a lot more credit. But he just kind of a nutty stage dad. And then when they fired him, he actually went out, as you probably know, went out and found a group to compete with his kids.
The Sunrays.
And then, you know, the Sunrays weren't writers. So where did their songs come from?
They had two decent hits. I don't know how well they did on the charts, but boy, they sure sounded like the Beach Boys.
No kidding. I wonder why.
Yeah, how can that be? And the drummer.
I think the songs were written by Brian. Again, Brian wrote so many songs.
Really? He wrote Andrea and I'll Follow the Sun for the competition for the Sunrays?
No. They were like Sir City. They were rejects that he never finished.
Oh, I'll be.
I'm not sure about that. Maybe some B-sides, but I'm pretty sure that I Live for the Sun sure sounds like a Brian Wilson.
Yeah.
I know that they recorded Brian Wilson throwaways.
That makes sense.
But that's up to you. Call your nerds. They'll look it up.
There's a really interesting version of Jingle Bell Rock on the internet, on YouTube. That's you and Mike Love. I love that version. I do. What's so funny?
Mike. He found all of these deals that he could get into that people would pay him to do these projects. But
it worked. It worked.
As long as he got a payday for it, none of that stuff really sold all that well. But if he got an initial payday for him and us, God bless him, I was okay with that.
I've never found a vinyl copy of that, but the version on YouTube, I really like it. I've put it on my radio show at Christmas time many times. It's a good song. Good version.
No, it is a good song. And Mike's, he's somewhat of a perfectionist. He makes sure that stuff is recorded right, that it's not something done in a garage.
Okay.
And he always used great musicians too as well. So the recordings were always really good. Some of the material that he would want me to sing, I cringed, but what the heck. It was his deal, and I got paid for it.
You've got a book chronicling the days of Jan and Dean, do you not? Is it out there? What's going on with that?
Yeah, it's like about two years old by now, I think.
What's the title?
Surf City.
That makes sense. Is it available everywhere? Amazon, online, bookstores? Where?
It was. It was on Amazon for a pretty long time. I still get reviews. 4.5 stars I got.
Cool.
It's pretty cool. I've seen it on eBay.
Okay. Dean, have we reached the end of the interview?
I don't know. It's 2 hours.
I didn't intend for part one to take an hour. I thought we could do this all in 40 minutes, but you tell some fascinating stories.
It's fun. You have some really good ones that are fun to answer.
Dean, it's been a real pleasure. I can't tell you how much I've enjoyed sitting around the Cracker Barrel talking with you about the history of Jan and Dean and all the fun and the melodrama and the crime. You've got everything going on.
And we didn't even get into the Manson encounter, because Dennis Wilson was one of my best buddies.
Okay,
so obviously, very close encounter with Manson.
You did? Wow. Mm-hmm. Oh, that's I want to ask you, but no, I said last question already. We'll save it for
last question. You can find the Surf City book, because I put that chapter in the book, and you can kind of get an idea of what that story is about.
I will buy it. Thank you so much for all the time and the cooperation. You didn't have to go all out as you did. I've been a fan, and I appreciate all the time you gave me, and thanks for opening up to the podcast here, and best wishes for you.
You're welcome. Thanks, man. It was great, as usual.
So that wraps up the third and final installment in this series of interviews with Dean Torrence, an amazing guy with an amazing life to talk about, and he's one of the best storytellers. So thanks again, Dean. Remember, more interviews with the hitmakers of the 50s, 60s, and 70s on the website, danmarcuswaxmuseum.com, and please find the Facebook page, Dan Marcus's Wax Museum. And please, next time you're on Facebook, look up Dan Marcus's Wax Museum and check the like box, please. It's appreciated. Thank you.